This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, we are getting back again here and getting our episodes going after returning from a rather lengthy trip out to Arizona. I took a long drive, actually, from Houston out to Phoenix. Spent a little bit of time before and after. I had some relatives to visit, plus I hung around to catch a lecture by Hal Myers, which we'll be having a podcast coming up with him sometime in the future. But in the meantime, I had been posting daily updates from the IBM convention there in Scottsdale, Arizona, a suburb of Phoenix, and it was a fantastic convention. I hope that you got that impression from the podcast updates that I had posted. It certainly had a lot of good talent, and it was a lot of fun, and they said nearly 500 people, including all of the talent and everybody, and I could really believe that. There were a lot of people there at the convention performing whom I've never seen that talented there before. So there were some first-time performers, so it was kind of cool. I also want to thank you guys very much for your patience, since I did not release a podcast last Thursday. I was trying to give everyone a little bit of time to get caught up and kind of digest everything that I had been posting. Of course, I had posted number 500, which was our episode with Uri Geller, and then in between there I had posted number 501 through 504 episodes, which were the daily updates from each of the 4 days at the convention. I kind of made it a little bit confusing, and I hope it wasn't too much confusion there for you. That is that I posted number 501 before I posted 500. The reason being is that I wanted just to have that Uri Geller episode out there a little bit longer, because I was afraid that if I posted 501 immediately after I normally released the Thursday morning podcast, which would have been 500, it wouldn't have been up for about an hour before that it would have been overwritten by the next one. When I say overwritten, there are some ways of listening to these podcasts in sequential order, and you may not have been able to catch that. So I gave you about 24 hours of time to catch 500. Of course, that one is available in the archives, and if you haven't had a chance to go back to listen to it, go to themagicwordpodcast.com, where you'll get a chance to go back and hear everything that Uri had to say. It was fantastic, and it was an epic episode, and I want to thank Uri very much again for being my guest, and also to Joe Corsillo, who helped facilitate that. Well, this week's episode is brought to you by the Friends of the Magic Word. Those are the people who have financially contributed, either on a one-time basis or perhaps through a monthly pledge, and I thank everybody who has participated over the years, and we have three different new Friends of the Magic Word who have pledged their financial assistance also. I want to thank Ryan Johnson, Carl Peffer, and from Oslo, Norway, Sune Alexandersen Narud. Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate your financial support in order to help this production continue to go on far into the future. Well, this week we're going to have an opportunity to have a conversation with quite an interesting fellow, and that is a nonagenarian. That means somebody who's over 90 years old. In fact, he's 91 years old, Mr. Ray Hyman. I thought it'd be a kind of a good follow-up after we had the conversation with Uri Geller to talk with a skeptic. And it's difficult to have a conversation right now with James Randi at his age, but this is about as close, I guess, as I can get right now at his age, who, by the way, Ray Hyman is a good friend of James Randi, and also, along with James and Martin Gardner, were the originators of the Skeptic organization way back when. And the guys who had helped facilitate this and who had brought Ray to my attention to begin with included Larry Soberson and Jay Frazier. So thank you, Jay and Larry, for putting Ray Hyman on my radar so I can have an opportunity to get together and for you to facilitate that Skype call that we were able to record to make this episode possible. So let me turn it over then now and let you enjoy this week's episode with Ray Hyman here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, And today that I have another special guest, someone that some of you may know and some of you who don't, but afterwards you're going to be glad that you heard this. It's with Ray Hyman, who has been around for a while. In fact, he was the former professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And of course, if Eugene, Oregon sounds kind of familiar, of course, that's because of Gerry Anderson being from that area then as well. And we'll get into that as well, because Ray was friends with Gerry. Also, as I understand, he was a founding member of the Committee of Skeptical Inquiry, which is the CSI. Also, he's on the cover of the Linking Ring magazine. I think that was back in 1952, and so also had an award for mentalism. So that's why I'm saying perhaps some of you may not remember him, but or have been born after that, perhaps may not have seen that. I mentioned his friend Gerry Andrus, and that actually helped him with the creation of his the book on the Andrus Card Control. Had a one-man parade in the Linking Ring back in 52, and also the member of the Academy of Magical Arts, and I'm sure he befriended a lot of magicians, of course, over the number of years of its 55 plus years that the Magic Castle has been around. And in fact, that I want to congratulate you. I understand you just turned 91 back on here June 23rd. So happy birthday.
Thank you.
So please welcome my guest today, Mr. Ray Hyman. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
So glad that you're here, and you're living in Los Angeles then now. Is that right?
Oh, no, I live in Eugene, Oregon.
I didn't know if you had lived in L.A., because I knew that you had a lot of friends there, of course, at the Magic Castle. So I thought it's just you. So you didn't live ever in L.A. You just kind of went down to the castle from time to time.
I unfortunately never have gotten to the castle a lot.
Okay.
It's a little far from me, you know. I'm up here in Oregon, and and that's down here in Southern Cal.
Right. Well, you kind of crossed the country, because weren't you born in Connecticut or someplace in the East Coast? Is that right?
Born in Massachusetts. Outside of Boston.
Right, right. And then migrated all the way to the Northwest. That's a long way from Massachusetts.
Yeah, I drove across the country in 1961 to take a job at the University of Oregon.
The reason I was mentioning the castle, I thought that you were a member of the Academy of Magical Arts, because I understand that you were a friend of Di Vernon's, but I know that there were many others through there that you befriended. Did you first meet Di through Gerry Anderus, or were you at the castle, or how did that come about?
No, I first met, it was called Day, and sometimes when he moved, he went to Di.
Right.
Because he was Day.
Right.
I first met him in 1953, a little earlier, maybe. There was I worked in New York City for a while, but this was before I got to work in New York City. And I was a friend of Stanley Jacks. Do you know of Stanley Jacks?
I do, and I wanted to talk about him then as well. Yeah, Dr. Stanley Jacks. Yes, but go ahead the story, yes.
I think it was 1950 in the Linking Ring. There was an Annenberg parade, and I was asked to contribute something to it, and I did. In fact, I contributed an effect which was called, I think it was called psychoanalysis, and it was the first of a couple effects that I got an award from the IBM for mentalism. But I contributed this effect to the Annenberg Parade, and alphabetically they had other contributors, and right next to me was a contribution by Stanley Jacks, you know, the famous mentalist.
Right.
And so we appeared side by side in that parade. I got a call from, I was living in, I'm going to school, that was 53. I was probably still going to school. Boston area.
Okay.
And I knew of Stanley Jacks, of course. He was famous, but I had never met him. And I got a phone call from him after the Linking Ring came out. And he said that he admired my effect. He liked my effect very much. And he wanted to know if I could give him permission to use it. Well, you know, you publish an effect in a magic magazine. Everyone has permission to use it.
That's right. It's free game.
But anyways, I said, sure, of course, I'd be honored. I knew of him, but I'd never met him. And then we talked, and he said he'd like to meet me sometime, and he travels around. He was on the lecture circuit, and his agent was the same agent that ran, that was the agent for Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of President Roosevelt.
Wow.
And And he said that every once in a while he does something in the Boston area. And next time he gets to the Boston area, he liked to call me and we'd go out to dinner or something like that. Well, that began a long, friendly relationship. You know, he did call me soon after that. We did have dinner. Then I was in New York several times and he took me around. And the most impressive thing I remember was that he once took me to his apartment. And since I didn't have a chance to ever see his act, full act that he does. His act, by the way, was called He Writes With Your Mind. And he knew, because he mostly did it for very private clubs, high level clubs. And so I happened to be, when the next time I happened to be in New York, he took me to his apartment and set everything up and did his whole act just as he does it on his circuit for me. And but explaining the psychology and everything else of each part of it. So that's quite impressive.
So it was kind of like a mini personal lecture. He performed and then explained.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
But we were friends until his death, and we exchanged a lot. He was very interested in the fact that I had done my honors thesis at, I think, Boston University on graphology. And he was very much interested in that. So he always wanted to see me. He also knew I was reading palms at that time.
Now, what is graphology? Is graphology the palm reading?
No, handwriting analysis.
Handwriting, yeah, okay.
But I did palmistry too, and he said that whenever he was in Boston area and I was doing palmistry, he wanted to know because he'd like to come and witness it or something like that. Well, I usually, when I did palmistry for money, I usually was part of a fair in some way or other, and I had a tent.
Oh, like a psychic fair thing, yeah.
Psychic fair type thing, right, and clients would come and they'd go in and begin, and you know, they'd pay me money, and of course I had to share the money with the organizers of the event. We split 50-50 usually or something like that. And so Stanley came to one of my events, when I was reading palms, and I sit in a booth, which is actually just a wooden frame with the curtains over everything. So Stanley would sit outside on a chair. And so he could hear me. He couldn't see what was going on, but he could hear my reading. And
right.
And between readings, he would love to talk to me. We could discuss it. And one time, he said, "Ray, wouldn't it be interesting if the next client came in and you read everything backwards? If her lifeline says that she's very imaginative, you say she's very rational. And if her heartline says she likes to show her emotions, you tell her she doesn't like to show her emotions."
Right.
Just for the heck of it.
Right.
Well, you know, I probably was a believer, and I've been doing palm reading I did it for 6 years. And I was, before I went to college, actually. And so, since it always worked, I got fantastic reactions from people. I believe it was sort of, you know, that something was there. I went along with Stan. I respected him. So next lady came in and I gave her a reading. And to my surprise, I'm used to, when I'm doing palm reading, getting a lot of feedback from people, because when I'm telling them things they want to hear, for example,
sure,
they're pushing their hands towards me. I'm telling them things they don't want to hear. They're pulling their hands, no, very subtly, away from me.
So it's kind of the body language, I guess, that you're paying attention to, not just what they're saying, but also how they're reacting or leaning forward or backwards or whatever. Yes.
And I realized even though I thought there maybe was something to palm reading, because I got always got positive reactions. People would tell people things that I could see you had some problems with your heart at age 5, and they would say, "Yeah, how did you know that? That was amazing." And you know, I get enough hits like that, but
yeah,
you know,
you start
random
to believe yourself.
Yeah. So anyway, so sure enough, the next lady comes into my booth, and I gave her a wrong reading, and she was absolutely stiff all during the reading. She motionless, and that's very disconcerting to me, because I depend a lot when I'm giving a reading on the fact that the people are very active. And it turned out that the reason she was so rigid and stiff was because she was absolutely startled how accurate I was.
Oh, you were spot on. Okay.
In fact, she said she had a lot of readings, but this was the best and the most accurate she's ever had.
Wow.
And this is when I was doing everything absolutely wrong. And that was the first time I began really questioning this, because I had been doing it for 6 years.
So did you change your method? And from then on, did you start just doing the opposite, or just thinking, I don't need to pay attention to what?
No, I was, this is before I got to college and got taught, learned about science and stuff like that. But what I did was I dropped doing it, actually. But I was going to, I actually continued my first year of college, too, because I remember the chairman of the psychology department heard I was doing professional readings, and he called me into his office. He was a big man. His name, he was Willem Pinard from South Africa originally, but he's big, huge man. And he called me into his office, and I wasn't a psychology major at that time. I was a journalism major, but he called me into his office, and he closed the door, and he says, don't you know, I hear you're doing, you read pounds for money. I says, yeah, just to get some little extra money. And he said, don't you know that that's a mythology, that's a superstition, and you should not be doing that. You're taking money under false pretenses. And he gave me a real lecture, you know, dressed him down. I wasn't bothered by it. I just waited till he calmed down, and I said, can you show me your hands? So he pulls palms out, and I gave him a reading. He didn't say anything. I left. And 2 weeks later, I think, I got a note from him saying, could you come to visit, see me again? So I went to his office, and he shut the door in his office, and as I got in there, and he sat down opposite me and put out both palms, and he says, could you tell me more?
And all of a sudden, he was a believer.
Well, whatever it was, but several more times during that semester, he called me into it, gave him some more readings.
Wow. And so that's when you decided to change to psychology from journalism.
Well, I think what did it was when Stanley Jacks suggested that, Ray, wouldn't it be interesting if you gave the next client a wrong reading?
Right.
And as soon as I did that for a few more clients, and they were just as amazed as it had been when I was doing it, the reading it the right way, I realized that whatever was going on, it had nothing to do with lines in the hand.
Right.
And so I decided I'll change my major in psychology with the idea that I'll learn what's going on here. And what I found out when I became a psychology major, that the psychologist was just as gullible as my palmistry clients, because they had things like the Rorschach test, the inkblot test, and they did all kinds of other stuff that I could tell was just not scientifically valid, you know. And these were top-notch psychologists, because you ever heard the inkblot test and stuff like that?
Sure.
That's all nonsense. There's no validity to it at all. I read the literature, and I got some scientific training, and I could tell that they're just as gullible as my palmistry clients. And so I got that began a career of my becoming a skeptic and.
Well, on palm reading, I understand that also you had met Percy Diaconis, and although I've never met Percy, I understand he's quite a gifted genius and in a lot of areas. But he had an interesting conversation with you about palm reading. Does he believe in that, or what was that story?
That story was probably in the 50s, 60s, or something like that. I had a I was on a sabbatical at Stanford, and Percy teaches at Stanford. He's a good friend. And he had a party. He was living in – he had an apartment in San Francisco, even though he was teaching at Stanford, which was, you know, about 50 miles down the road. But he commuted. So he had a party in San Francisco one time, and both Jerry Andrus and I happened – I don't know how – we both happened to be in San Francisco at the same time. We were invited to the party, and we were at his had this party at his house, and most of the people at his party were faculty members from Stanford, where Percy was teaching and still teaches. And Percy asked Jerry to do some of his stuff, and, you know, Jerry is probably one of the greatest close-up magicians ever, and he really wowed the people. He did all this great great magic. And then Percy suggested that there was a man, Brad Efron, who was a very famous statistician at the time, young man, but he invented, very famous for inventing a very interesting statistical procedure. And so he was part of the party. And for some reason, Percy said, why don't you give Brad Efron a reading?
So Percy knew that you were a palm reader and you knew how to do that.
Yeah.
Right.
So I gave Brad Efron, these are all academics from Stanford. And I gave Brad Efron a palm reading, and he was very still. I thought he was very interested, but he didn't say anything. And then the party went on, and apparently he went back to the kitchen, and Percy went with him, and he said to Percy, you know, this is something special. I this guy knows something. Did you tell him about my life and everything else? He says, Percy said, no, I never told him anything about you. And he says, well, this is very special. This palmistry, there's something to it, must be something to it. Remember, this is Brad Efron, he's still there. Brad Efron is one of the top statisticians along with Percy Diaconis at Stanford University. But he was absolutely dumbfounded by that. And then the next day, I was on sabbatical teaching at Stanford at the time. So, and Percy was in the statistics department. I was in the psychology department. And Percy came over to see me and said, you know, Brad was very impressed. He's still talking about the palm reading, you know. And Tom Waters, you ever hear of Tom Waters?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Tom Waters was also at that party. And in one of Tom Waters' books, he wrote about being at this party. He wanted to make a point that as good as, you know, you can do the greatest magic in the world, but doing a reading of some sort is going to overshadow anything, the best magic you could do. As an example was that at this party at Percy's house, Jerry Andrus did magic, and Jerry is the best close-up magician in the world, as far as I'm concerned. He's a good, one of my best friends for 50 years until he passed away. In fact, I was with him when he passed away. But anyway, he asked Jerry to perform, and Jerry did his stuff. And believe me, I don't know if you ever saw Jerry Andrus.
I have. You know, I met Jerry many years ago. He used to attend the 4F convention out in Buffalo, and he had been there a few times and lectured and performed, and I got to meet him. But, a very good close-up magician and a nice fella then, too. So, anyhow, they said that the guy, so Tom Waters had also was at the same party and was saying that this is very strong. Yeah, because palm reading is kind of like mind reading. When you're reaching into someone's mind, you're telling someone about themselves that no one else really knows. That's pretty powerful, as opposed to just doing a card trick. Card tricks can be impressive, but when you're telling something to someone, you're reaching in their mind. It's different than reaching in their pocket.
Well, since then, I actually do a lot of seminars. I still do once in a while on cold reading. Usually at skeptics conferences.
Right.
And I teach people how to do a reading on someone. Typically I have maybe a few hundred people in the audience. I have them pair them into partners. And then I teach them how to give each other a reading. And then I ask them to rate each one, rates the accuracy of on a scale from 0 to 100 of the reading they had been given. Remember, this is each of the people in the pair had never done a reading before. These are usually skeptics, but in 15 minutes or so, I teach them how to tell them how to do a reading, and then they give each other a reading and rate it. Well, over the years, it's been quite consistent. The average accuracy rating of the readings that people give each other under these conditions is 85%. And that's as good as you get. In other words, I think that the best readers who are out there and probably wouldn't get a much better rating than that. And my point is that, you know, in 5 minutes or 15 minutes, I can teach people how to give a reading. It's going to be just as good as a reading that you would get from a professional reader.
Now, you say you do workshops, but have you released DVDs or anything where people can go online or buy something from you where they can learn that, or do they have to take private lessons?
sell anything, but yeah, I have some DVDs, come to think of it here, of me doing it and running a workshop. I've done workshops for skeptics groups where I, in fact, I think if you go on YouTube, look up Ray Hyman, you'll get at least a couple of, at least one of those things you get is me doing a whole 2 hour or so course before a group of skeptics, usually teaching them how to do readings.
Wow, good, okay. I'll look for that, and if I can find that, I'll post that also then on our blog.
Yeah, there are other things about me if you look me up there, but there's a whole course on I have on there too. But look up Ray Hyman, maybe just cold reading or something like that, and I think that'll come up easily.
Well, obviously, with skeptics, the first person that comes to mind is James Randi. I know that you and James are good friends.
Oh yeah, we're good friends. We Randi and I and Martin Gardner, and we're both sort of disciples of Martin Gardner. We began the skeptical movement in 1973. Both Randi and I had encounters with Geller, Uri Geller, and this incensed Randi no end. And so Randi was traveling in 1973, I think it was. He was on a tour with Alice Cooper. Ever hear of Alice Cooper?
Well, of course, yes, of course, the rock musician.
And he was traveling with, in 1973 it was, it's about that, yeah. He was traveling with the Alice Cooper show, and he was sort of during the show, he's a mad doctor where he extracts a huge tooth out of Alice Cooper's mouth that's as big as his head. And the show, the Alice Cooper show, ended where Randi puts Alice Cooper's head into a guillotine and chops it off. And it falls into a basket, and then Randi picks the head of Alice Cooper up with blood booping out of it and dances around the stage, and then it all goes dark. And then it's stuck for quite a while. It seems like quite a while.
Yeah.
And then there's what something like called resurrection music or something like that. And gradually the curtain rises, and Alice is resurrected.
Something fully restored. Like his head is restored. Cut and restored head.
Right, yeah. So, but Randi was part of that show. And when they came to Portland, I got a call from Randi. I live in Eugene, which is a 2 hour drive from Portland. But Randi called me and said, Ray, he said, you got to come up. We're at the Coliseum in Portland where, Alice is doing a show he's on tour. And by the way, I don't know much about popular culture. So at that time, I thought when he's saying Alice Cooper, that was a she.
Was a she, of course. Alice is a female name, right?
Yeah, Alice wants you to come up here to watch the show. He wants to put you on a stage and so you can both watch the show and his audience, because he's trying to figure out the makeup of his audience. What makes it, why it's peculiar? He has pre-teenagers. No high schoolers, no one in between, and then college kids. But somehow there's this gap, and he wants to try and figure out why that's so. So Randi, apparently, who's traveling with the show, convinced him that he ought to call me. I could figure it out for him, something like
okay.
that.
Yeah, because you knew psychology.
So when I got there, they were staying at a hotel near the Coliseum in Portland. Went into the motel, and I immediately bumped into Randi. He was wandering around the halls of the motel. And first thing he said to me, he said, you know, we got to do something about Uri Geller. And he said, why don't we form a skeptics group?
Did you know Uri or before then? Or?
Yeah, I had been one of the first people to. I was sent by the Defense Department in 1972. I remember, yeah, December 1972 to look at Uri Geller. And I had people studying him at the Stanford Research Institute. So I was actually called by the Defense Department to do that.
We'll get into that story in just a minute. So go ahead and finish this one. So Randi said, we need to do something about Uri. And you said what?
I didn't say much at all. I wasn't that keen. Randi is really hates, you know, Randi and I are both skeptics. We're good friends. But there are all kinds of quack people out there, you know, quacks and people doing crazy things. And you know, I'm a skeptic, and I'm one of the people who debunk all these quacks. But and even Geller, I've written a lot about Geller. But I'm not emotional about it. You know, in fact, Geller still claims I'm his good friend. He's my best friend, something like that.
He's a very charismatic fellow. We just had him on the podcast, and he is very charismatic.
Oh yeah, he's quite something, and I've known him right from the beginning. I first studied him at Stanford. I was sent by the government of all places to look at him when they were studying him at the Stanford Research Institute. That was about 1953 or so. And I was asked actually I got a call from Colonel Austin Kibler. He was then head of the Advanced Research Projects Agency for the Defense Department. And he called me and said, Ray, could you go down to Palo Alto, to Menlo Park actually, and look at, the people at the Stanford Research Institute who are investigating Geller and see what they're doing with Geller and they said to me, this Colonel Kibler, who's calling me, he says, you know, I know you are a skeptic, but, you know, there are other people who have seen Geller, and they're not so sure. And since he can bend metal with his mind, the Defense Department has an interest in the possibility of using this as a weapon of some sort. So he said, could you go down there look at him and the people studying him and stuff like that. So they finally convinced me to go down there. This was December 1972. You know, I remember that, yeah, because I was grading papers at the time. And I said, I can't go because I'm grading papers. He said, no, you got to go right now because he may go away anytime at all. He's a very volatile guy, and he may. There's some talk about they're doing a Broadway play with him in it and featuring him and his powers. So I did go down to Stanford Research Institute and spent the day watching Geller doing his stuff and so on. And they sent, not only did they send me there, because they sent me because I'm a skeptic and a magician and a psychologist. And they said, thought if there's anything tricky going on, I would be able to detect it. On the other hand, if there's anything real that's going on, you need a parapsychologist to do that. And they, along with me, they had a parapsychologist. And the idea was that if that's the way the Defense Department thinks, that if there's anything real about Geller, you need a parapsychologist to detect it. If there's anything fake about him, you need someone like me. They didn't count on the fact that the parapsychologist decided Geller's for real. And I said, this guy is 100% fake. So anyway, these things go on in our government anyway, so I'm not surprised by it anymore. I get a lot of committees to look at psychic, and well, it's amazing how many things that our government was willing to get interested in, but they on the other hand, there are enough skeptics in the government to say, well, you got to have Ray Hyman go in here too and look at it. And everything was just people being taken by the nose. And
well, I know one of the things that you were involved with, I think, was neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP. That the military was interested in and wanted you to come in and give some advice?
It was the Army Research Institute. I was on a committee that was dealing with a lot of questionable things like sleep learning and stuff like that that our government or our military was paying money to study or to use. And so they when they formed that committee, they had someone looking at sleep learning and some other things. But someone said, hey, what about psychics? And so psychic phenomena, there are all kinds of people, things going on in our government and the Russian government where they're using psychics and for psychic warfare and stuff like that. So when that came up, they said, well, they called me and said, would I come in and join the committee because they need someone to study the, you know, parapsychological claims.
Right. Yeah, from that angle. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's how I got involved in some. Well, I keep getting involved in stuff like that. Once you get called in for something like that, then become the expert. So I've looked at ladies who can, this lady who can read with her fingertips, and I've had all government interest in these things. And
now the Russians were involved, I believe, also. I thought they had their own program because that was during the Cold War when we felt like perhaps that we could have some psychics doing some things here, and the Russians were experimenting with their own psychics, I think, on their side then also. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, there was the Soviet Union then, and I wasn't that concerned about parapsychology, because I'm saying there's nothing to it. You know, I've been investigated. In fact, I have written about 50 papers now and published papers on parapsychology, debunking it, of course. So, and I wasn't interested, because I find it very boring, because it's all statistics and stuff like that, and nothing exciting. Geller is exciting, at least. He's a magician, and he does clever stuff. But
he does.
Most of our psychology is very boring statistics, where they run these experiments where people guess the ESP cards, and if they can guess better than chance, they think they've got something. And, of course, it's what they've got is the fact that if you run enough experiments, just that there's something called chance, that by chance you're going to get something that looks like something. But that's just chance.
Sure.
And that's all he's been getting.
Is it basically 50-50 as far as chance? If it's better than 50%, then there might be something to it?
Well, it's like, you got the idea. It's a little simple. It's more complicated than that a little bit. But, yeah, they use fancy statistics and stuff like that. And they're very serious, and they run these experiments. They still exist, and they run them, and they have their own journals and stuff like that. And they assure something is there, even though it's not consistent and it's very hard to replicate. And I have been called in by our government several times to evaluate some of that, because our government had several people, you know, at Fort Leavenworth at one point. There was a whole group of military people who were into parapsychology, because you have the Russians. In fact, they always told me, if you see what the Russians are doing, you wouldn't be so skeptical about what's going on. And so I took 3 months to get security clearance. And I was able to see all the secret stuff we had on what the Russians were doing. It was pathetic.
Wow. So you could kind of analyze what the Russians were doing and see also, yeah, well, it was pathetic that they weren't doing anything that was real either.
Well, it's a game. The Russian parapsychologists, they have a bunch of parapsychologists in Russia, and they kept trying to convince their government that was the Soviet Union then, that the Americans were much far ahead of them in what they called psi warfare. The idea was they're going to use psychic phenomena for the future of military confrontations. And so the Russians, and I got to know a lot about this finally. I figured I saw what the Russians were doing. They're playing the same game as the American parapsychologists were doing. There were a lot of American parapsychologists in our government, military, and other places that are quite influential. And they were convincing our government, trying to convince our government, that there's something called the psi gap. Psi means psychic. Psi gap between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
That the Russians were far ahead of us in the development of psychic warfare. And we got to catch up. And what I found when I was put into the situation, was able to see what took 3 months to get the right kind of clearance so I could see all the secret stuff our government had and what the Russians were doing in this area. And what I found is that the Russians parapsychologists were convincing their government that it was a psi gap, that the Americans were very far ahead of them in psychic warfare. And so that's their way of getting money from the Soviet government to help to support their reason.
I see.
And our parents in this country were convincing our government that there was a side gap, that the Russians were far ahead of us in this. And that's how they were getting their money.
So it was all about money. All about money.
Yep.
Somebody getting paid. That's interesting. Let me go back also to the finish of the story. You were saying that whenever that Randy and Alice Cooper had invited you up, did you eventually go on stage then with Alice Cooper and find out when you were sitting and watching the show why there was that gap between the preteens and the college age people and why there weren't any people?
Well, what happened there, I did go up there and I met Alice Cooper, who was a he and a very nice guy in some ways. So I spent some time with him and his group. Now, the one thing I noticed that, of course, all his people in his band and stuff like that were on drugs, quite obviously. Alice was not taking drugs. He was on hooked on beer. And he always had one guy all the time who was with him, stood by him all the time, even on stage, and handing him a can of beer, an open can of beer, and then when that was empty, he'd take that and give him a new can of beer. So he was 100% of the time he was drinking beer.
He actually had a beer guy. Okay.
It had to be Coors beer, and at that time, Coors beer was not allowed. You couldn't get it in the state of Oregon, for example.
Yeah, there were certain states. Yeah,
So Alice traveled with two Boeing. He had two planes, two Boeing. I think they were Boeing, big Boeing planes. And one plane carried his troop and all their instruments and stuff. And the other plane just carried Coors beer for Alice. Because Alice was, every time I was with him, all during the day when he was in the hotel room and then when they got ready for the show, we drove to the show and they put me on a stage. Fortunately, they gave me good earplugs because I was right beside the speakers. Because Alice wanted me to sit on a stage where I could watch the show and him, you know, and his audience at the same time in the front rows, the kids climbing up there. And they did this in sets, you know, Alice would do something and then the curtains would come down and everything would go black, rather. And he would, and then the lights would go on again and he'd do his next set and so on. And in between sets, he would run over to me when the lights went down and talk to me about what was going to come up next and what to watch for and so on. And what I found quickly was that he didn't need me. He was a better psychologist. Anyway, he knew better why his audience was there, because he'd run up to me and say, "Now look, during the next set, I'm going to insult their parents of the kids there, and they're going to get mad at me, and I'm going to throw dollar bills out at them. They're going to throw dollar bills back at me." He had complete control of that. It looked like chaos, but he knew what was happening and why he was doing it. The whole show, he had an anaconda live anaconda around his shoulders, which he had. And then also, during the show, he was seemingly getting progressively more and more drunk because he was always drinking the beer. He had the guy send him a can of beer, and then he'd get another can of beer and so on. And each time, the lights would go on, and he would go off, and then he would stand up and run over to me and explain to me what was going to happen next. And he'd run back, and the lights would go on, and he was looking like he was hanging on to the microphone stand as he was going and getting ever more seemingly drunk and getting unsteady and falling near to the floor. But it was all an act, because as soon as the lights went out between sets, he would stand up straight and run over to me and tell me what's going to happen next.
So really you were not able to help him try to get a better demographic for that high school group, but he knew what he was doing. And so,
I have no idea why they had me up there. I think Randy just wanted me up there for other reasons.
must have been the reason. Another thing I wanted to go back, I mentioned Di Vernon earlier, that I understand that you had a center tear. Did you come up with this center tear yourself, or was it something that you'd learned from Stanley Jacks or somebody and was sharing with Di or Day?
Oh, no. I had my own tear. It's called the eccentric tear. And that was published in the Linking Ring, of course, along with all the other stuff I used to publish. Also, a version with Genie, Rockenbauer. John Rockenbauer begged me to let him write it up in Genie, so I did. What happened was that in 1950s, early 50s, Stanley Jackson, whenever you're in New York, Ray, let me know if it's going to be a Saturday, because every Saturday night, Bruce Elliott holds what he calls a sodality at his house. And every magician in town who's who goes to that sodality. And he says, whenever you're in New York, call me up and if it's going to be a Saturday night, I will take you there. And so you can come in there and you meet all the magicians of New York, whoever's who is there, you know. So the next time I was in New York, I called Stanley and he said, "Oh, great." So he took me to this Bruce Elliott Sodality, and I went to a few others after that. And there at Bruce Elliott Sodality was just about every magician who's who. You know, it was quite amazing. And Vernon was there, of course. And
how about Harry Lorraine? Was he there back then?
No, I never met Harry Lorraine in person. So he wasn't there, but almost every other magician, Jay Marshall, showed up. It was quite dramatic. It was a New York-type party. Hen Fetch was visiting from Baltimore. I knew Hen Fetch because I went to Johns Hopkins for my PhD. And while I was living in Baltimore, I was invited to be part of a very elite magician called the Mystic Five, Mystic Seven. It's supposed to be only seven magicians can be part of it. But somehow or other, they invited me to be one. So we would meet once a month, and the idea was we all had to try to fool each other.
Do you remember who else was part of the Mystic Seven?
Yeah, Hen Fetch was my good friend. You remember Hen Fetch?
I do remember, yeah, Hen Fetch. Yeah, I think he'd come up with, he wasn't the one that had Professor's Nightmare, but I believe he had some rope trick that he was well known for, among other things then, too. So he was one. So there are five other people. Do you remember who all was member of the Mystic Seven?
It'll take me a while to remember their names.
That's okay. Never mind.
But Hen was the one key one. And the idea was that the Mystic Seven would meet at someone's house in Baltimore once a month. And the idea was we all should come prepared to something which we could fool the others with. And the only guy who consistently was successful at fooling everyone was Hen Fetch, who was a good friend, became a good friend of mine while I was in graduate school. Hen used to work, that was interesting, he worked at the public electric company in Baltimore, but the city had its own electric company. And everything was different then. It was 1950s. And so Hen's job was, there were three people who had this job. Hen always worked the evening thing. He began around midnight and, well, before midnight, but then he ended at 2 o'clock because he would have me come stay with him sometimes. And we spent a lot of time together. It was a lot of fun, at night all by ourselves. And what his job was at that time, the electricity that goes to each company in Baltimore was measured, each was a separate meter for each company. It wasn't as automated as it is today. And so Hen's job was, when during his 7-hour stint, was to once an hour, each hour, go around and make a write down for each major company that was using electricity, what their meter was reading. And he just write it down. That's it. That'd take only 5 minutes or so. And then the rest of the time he had free. And so I would spend sometimes his whole shift with him, and we were just doing magic, talking magic. And then after the shift was over around 2 o'clock, and we'd go to a nice Italian restaurant that was stay open. In those days, there were restaurants open all night. Well, this one stayed open till 2 o'clock at least, and have a nice Italian meal. So I spent a lot of time with Hen, and we actually put out some magic together. Marketed some magic together. And my only published, maybe 3 or 4 things I have published and sold, marketed in magic as effects, among all effects I created, most of my put in magic magazines.
So you were at this party then with everybody and a lot of other magicians, and you said that Day had come in. Dave Vernon had come in, and you were going to show him your center terror?
No. Vernon was already there, and when I was there. And Stanley introduced me to Vernon the first time I was there at this Bruce Elliott Sodality in New York. And to my surprise, I used to do my stand-up card. Magic was I did the cards of the pocket. That was one of my feature tricks, I did. And so Stanley just walks me up to Vernon the very first time I met him. He walked me up to him, and because I knew who he was, and he said, introduced me. He said, "Ray, why don't you do your cards of the pocket for Dave Vernon?" And here I was, just great, just the greatest card guy in the world. And here's this kid. Well, I was 21, I think, at the time. He suddenly asked me to do my cards to the pocket for Dave Vernon. I was shaking I'm sure I was pretty weird, but I did it. And Vernon was very kind. He said nice things about it, but that's so we discussed that a little bit. But then Vernon knew of me, and he had just published in the latest, at that time, the latest edition. They were publishing the Tarbell course one volume at a time. And he had the volume that was published. I don't know how many people know this, but Vernon had submitted, had a sentateur thing in it, I mean, a mentalism thing, where as a result of getting the sentence here, how to read it surreptitiously.
Right.
In a very clever way. And so it's in the, I'm not sure which volume of the Tarbell, but it's in there. Well, that's just come out, that Tarbell volume. And, Vernon wanted to talk, knew I was a mentalist, and I wanted to talk cards or see him do cards, but he wanted to talk mentalism with me. And also, especially sentences and stuff like that. And he knew I had done, at that time I hadn't invented. In fact, I did invent something called the eccentric tear, which, is, many people think is one of the best, secret ways of getting writing on that people put on a piece of paper. So he wanted to discuss sentence tears and ways of getting information off of papers. And I wanted, I was interested in card magic, but even more interested in mentalism. So we talked a lot about that. And around 2 o'clock in the morning, Bruce Elliott kicks everyone out of his apartment. And all of us who were in the apartment, several well-known magicians, there was Stanley Jacks and Jay Marshall, so on, all walked to the automat, which was open around 2 o'clock, I guess. So it was the only thing that was open at that time. You know what an automat is?
Yeah, that's a place where they have sandwiches and things that are in like a vending machine.
Right, exactly. And so we all went to the automat because everything else was closed, and it's about 2 in the morning, I guess. And then the automat closed around 4. And so all this time, Vernon is talking with me about sentiteras and mentalism and stuff like that. So they finally closed the automat down too, and I think it was around 4 in the morning or something like that, and Vernon still's talking with me. We're standing on a street corner in New York City, and the sun finally is coming up, and the dawn, we're still talking. Sentiteras and stuff. And, well, I didn't see him again for another, that was probably about 1953 or something like that. And then the next time I saw Vernon was he was on West Coast too, but I was at a magic convention in Santa Barbara, I think it was. And I was standing in the dealer's room, and someone taps on my back. I turn around, it's Vernon. He's then in his 90s. And a little shriveled compared to when I last saw him.
Yeah.
But he says, "Ray?" Now, I hadn't seen him now since for 20 years, maybe, I think, like that. And he remembered me, Ray, and he began the conversation, Tom began talking as if we were continuing the conversation we last had under this.
Picked it right up where he left off, yeah.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy, he had quite a mind. And he was in his 90s at that point, which I am now, but it was amazing. He was shrunk, he was shriveled quite a bit, but his mind was unbelievable. We were continuing the same conversations as if we hadn't left off, and right. It was amazing.
Right, right. Well, Ray, listen, as we start to wrap up over here, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast, and I'm always curious to know what it is that is a person's philosophy. What is it that you live by? Is there a phrase or a mantra, not necessarily a word, but, something that's important to you?
One of the most important things to me is that, in fact, I've written a lot about it in psychology, is how smart people can go wrong. In other words, and also as a magician, very smart people, no matter how smart you are, in fact, sometimes if you're very smart, it's much easier to fool you. And so I've always been fascinated by that issue, and I've written a lot about how smart and why smart people can go wrong. And the simple answer is because they are smart. And they think they realize they're smart, so it's easier to lead them down a garden path and take advantage of them.
Yeah, so no matter how smart you are, you can still be fooled, basically.
Yes, in fact, it's probably more so you can be taken because you are smart. if you weren't very, in fact, even for magicians and stuff like that, if your audience is not very smart, you're not going to have a good time fooling them. Not, in fact, you might not be able to fool them. You know, that's why they say kids, the hardest thing for most magicians, the hardest thing is to deal with children. That's why children's magic is a specialty.
Because you've only done like one kid show in your whole life, is that right?
That was it. That was enough for me. Yeah, kids, the whole point is that kids below a certain age, if you look to the side as typically do, you don't need much to misdirect people. If you suddenly look the other way, this way, all adults look the same way. Kids, if below a certain age, their eyes will go any which way, you know. You can't misdirect right. them in any sensible way. Yeah, and kids, that's why children's magic has to be a specialty, because they're a different breed of animal from adults.
Yeah, absolutely.
And adults, you can count on misdirection and so on. With kids, you can't. You know, you may look this way, and all adults will look that way even for a little bit to misdirect them. That's hard to do with kids.
No, that's true. I'd done a show once for some engineers, actually some astronauts as well, in NASA, and I think it was one of the greatest testimonials. It's like you fooled a whole room of scientists and astronauts here. And then also when I performed at Mensa, for a Mensa group one time, I thought this is going to be difficult, but found that to be one of the easiest groups. So, yeah, the smarter you are, it seems like I hate to say gullible, but at least the easier sometimes they are to fool, because they think logically.
Yes, you know how they work. If the minds are working logically and sensibly, so you can deal with that, as a magician can exploit that. But if you're dealing with children or people below a certain age who aren't socialized, it's harder to control their attention. In fact, you might look left, some of them look right, and so on. And so it's much more difficult. And that's why children's magic is a specialty. Now, a lot of children's magic is not what we would call magic. It's more like balloons and stuff like that. But you can't use adult magic for children below a certain age. It's just not going to work.
Right, right. Well, Ray, thanks very much. I appreciate you being my guest here today. I enjoyed the conversation and giving us kind of a little enlightenment on some of the names and history from the past that we've not heard before. So thanks a lot.
Okay, you're welcome. And I'm sorry that I rambled, but I enjoyed it anyway.
That's quite all right. You rambled in the right directions, and that was quite fascinating. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Ray Hyman. This is Scotty out. Well, that was a very interesting conversation with Ray. I learned a lot right there. I'm glad that Jay and Larry put me in touch with Ray. I'd not had an opportunity to chat with him, and you can see he was quite a congenial gentleman and has just a vast array of knowledge, certainly, and some wonderful stories. I enjoyed hearing each and every one of them. By the way, he had talked a little bit about Hen Fetch, and Hen, I had mentioned, I didn't think was the one who was responsible for the professor's nightmare, but actually, as I was going back and doing a little bit of research, he was the one that became inspiration for the professor's nightmare. He had a couple of things, his rope session with Hen Fetch, which was published in 1954, and the quad ropeless routine in the U.S., which was 1955, became the inspiration for the classic professor's nightmare effect. But he was the one, also, speaking of epic effects, he'd created silk epic, rope epic, and the one that many magicians and mentalists use today is mental epic. He had many other effects also he had invented along with his partner Gene Gordon. So that just kind of clarifies a little bit more of who Hen Fetch was. He died back in 1961. So I thank you guys very much again for tuning in here this week, and also again I want to thank the Friends of the Magic Word for making this possible through their financial support. If you want to find out more about how to do that, just go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and you can do a one-time donation. Up at the very top left there is a little PayPal icon. You can click on that or visit patreon.com/themagicword, and there you can make a monthly pledge that way as well. You can pledge through PayPal one time or through a monthly pledge, however you wish. Any support would all be appreciated. Well, if you have not yet signed up for our pod letter, that is our weekly newsletter, then be sure and do that. Whenever you go to themagicwordpodcast.com, you'll see a little pop-up if you haven't already subscribed to give you the opportunity to sign up for our newsletter, and we'll let you know who's coming up from week to week. And also, if we have special
special prizes or some contests and things that are coming up, you get to be the first ones to know about that then, too. And also, a few suggestions on some of the conversations we'd had from the archives that you may have overlooked, or perhaps you might need to go back and take another listen in order to hear some interesting conversations with some of the guests I've had over the years. So, until next week, stay well, get booked,
and remember, regardless how smart your audience might be, you can still fool them. This is Scotty out.